Yeah, I live and work on a retreat centre. So going on retreat is my job, which is slightly strange. And yeah, so I looked on the Bristol Buddhist Centre website to find out what I was supposed to be giving this talk on. Actually, Chvalamolini had already written it down. She said I was going to write about living in a retreat centre and about my time that I spent at Camp Arabi, which was a sort of like,
As a guest.
yes, it was a guess. So I thought, okay, I'll talk about that. So that was a sort of 6 month retreat in a way. I'll explain that in a minute. So I thought I'd kind of start the talk by telling a little story in a way, which is about one of the early retreats, one of the first retreats that I went on after I became a Mitra. And I went down to Rivendell for a week-long newcomers retreat, and I took my sister, which is why I went on a newcomers retreat in particular. I took my younger sister, who was kind of interested in or wanted to, I suppose in a way she wanted to check out what I was getting into and how much of a cult it was really. She wasn't very convinced. So I thought best way to spend some good time with my sister and also for her to see a bit more of my life was for her to come on a retreat with me. At that point, there were four guys running Rivendell, and one of them was a guy called Sagravajra. And I hadn't met him before. At one point, he told us a bit about his life, and he said that when he was a kid, he'd ended up studying marine biology at university. That's right. He'd wanted to be a marine biologist when he was a kid, and he'd ended up studying that at university. And then coming across the Dharma, he'd ended up living and working on a retreat centre. And he said, well, in a way, that seems like a huge shift in your life. People would say, oh my goodness, well, that's a major life change, really, wouldn't they? However, he said, looking back on it, he'd realised that his inspiration for becoming a marine biologist had come from watching those TV sort of series about Jacques Cousteau, a guy who used to spend his time diving into the oceans and making TV about it. And he was sort of describing how his sort of image of Jacques Cousteau was that he spent his life living on this ship with some other guys. And they were, in a way, they were dedicated to exploring the depths of the ocean and coming back and communicating about it. And I sort of had this image. I mean, I don't know how much of that stuff I watched when I was a kid, but it's image of these sort of rather strange and slightly frightening sort of shaped fishes that came up out of the depths. And Sagravajra said that when he looked back on this kind of story from his childhood, he realised that actually his present life, the life that he was leading in this retreat centre, had strong similarities. He was living with a small group of guys on this boat, small group of friends, and they kind of dedicated their lives really, in their retreat centre, this boat. They dedicated their lives to helping each other discover the sort of depths of their hearts, really. The depths of your heart mind is where you're going when you meditate. And he saw their meditation practice together as like diving down, sort of through successive layers, kind of, isn't there? There's a kind of sense of diving down through layers of blueness in search of strange and shy and sometimes even quite frightening creatures that you might find living there. And recently, I've been reading. I think it was when I was thinking about giving this talk, I was remembering that not that long ago I finished rereading Moby Dick, which is the story of the slightly mad ship's captain who decides he wants to find a whale, basically. It's a story of a vengeful captain searching the seas for a great white whale. Such an amazing image, isn't it? And apparently, this great white whale had bitten off his leg on a previous journey. And the captain was kind of dedicating himself to finishing off the whale. And in the final battle with the whale, it's like the whole ship and all the crew, except for the guy who wrote the story, the whole rest of the crew are destroyed by this whale as it dies, finally dies. So I've been thinking about this image actually, these sort of ocean, these kind of ocean images, and I noticed that quite often, as I start a retreat at Te Rātana Loka, so I do several of these retreats each year, and during the retreats, I usually head up or facilitate a smallish study group, And there's a sense when we first all arrived together on the retreat, we're sort of just kind of getting to know each other, finding out who we all are. And then after about day three, we're all sort of settled in a bit, and you kind of have this feeling. It's a bit like the whole retreat centre, the whole kind of retreat, and our little group are kind of like moving away from the key, somehow moving away from the land, and kind of moving into a kind of more free floating environment where time and space seem sort of subtly different. And I was thinking it's a bit like we were all sort of collectively setting sail, sort of launching ourselves out into this slightly trackless kind of sea. And from the outside, it can even look a bit mad, really, a bit odd to be searching. I suppose in a way on retreat what we're doing is we're searching for the source of our suffering, for the source of human suffering. I was thinking you could see that as a slightly monomaniac adventure and possibly even quite dangerous. I was getting slightly over the top when I was writing this. It's a bit like we're sort of deliberately courting a kind of death, what we'd sort of refer to in Buddhism as a kind of spiritual death, the death of the ego. And, I say there's a slightly stream of consciousness feeling about this talk, I'm afraid. But I used to be a rock climber. I used to climb rocks, including some of the ones locally to here, actually. I went and had a quick look at the Clifton Suspension Bridge earlier today, and I was remembering climbing on the Avon Gorge there some years ago. And as a rock climber, I didn't really think about this as being something to do with, you know, courting death. I was actually quite a nervous climber. I was, quite nervous and anxious, and I didn't do anything very dangerous. But one thing I loved about climbing, one thing I really, really got me about it, was the actually, well, it was the very strong friendships that I developed while I was doing this rather mad activity. And it wasn't like I hadn't had other groups of friends. I was sort of looking a bit back at my life, and I was thinking, well, at university I had a bunch of mates, and we spent a lot of time sort of discussing life and philosophy and getting drunk. And then later in my life, I became quite strongly socialist and a member of the Labour Party. And again, we'd spend quite a lot of time arguing at great length about all sorts of things and, getting drunk. And then a bit later on still, I got quite involved in feminism. And we all agreed a lot on the sort of details of patriarchy and sexism and stuff, and didn't actually drink quite as much as my other groups of friends. But it seemed like my climbing friendships seemed actually sort of quite fundamentally different from these groups of friends that I'd known before. And I was thinking again about sort of, there's kind of a lot of images in climbing that come to mind every now and then. I don't climb anymore. But there's a sort of moment when you tie the rope on, so you're wearing a little harness and you tie a rope on, and then the other person ties the rope on the other end of the rope onto their harness, and you're kind of linked with this length of about 50 metres of rope. And when you might spend the best part of a day tied up to another person, which is quite a strong image, really, in a way, if you think about it. But it means that when you're taking on, as you sort of tie that knot, you're taking on that if one of you falls, then the other one's going to either save your life or else fall too. So it's quite a strong sort of image, I think, in this sort of moment of tying yourself together. So in a way, each of you is taking responsibility for the other person's life, well-being, kind of. And there's a level of trust in those kind of connections that I'd never really experienced before, and it was very important to me. And you get to know people pretty well when you're doing that kind of activity. It's kind of, and it's kind of not through all the words. I had used a lot of words in my previous experience of connections with people, a lot of discussions and arguments and, you know, pondering life and all the rest of it. But through climbing, there was a different way of communicating with each other, I suppose. And you also quickly find out if you share a sense of humour with somebody, if you're tied to them for the whole day. Yeah. So anyway, coming back to my life at the moment, I live and work at the retreat centre out in South Wales in the Brecon Beacons, very, very beautiful area. It's a big old house, and there's a team of eight of us who run this centre. We run it all. We do everything from cleaning the gutters to running the retreats themselves, leading the retreats themselves. And the retreats that we run are specifically aimed at women who have asked for ordination and they're specifically aimed at helping women join the order. And so as, you know, as people come on my retreats, I get to know them and build up friendships over the years with the people coming on the retreats, and then also I've got friendships with the women who I work with, my team. And I, you know, I myself actually did about 10 of these retreats. I did the retreats myself during the 7 years between asking for ordination and getting ordained. I went on about 10 of these retreats. And in fact, as it happens, the very first retreat that I did after I got, after I asked for ordination, happened to be the first retreat that they scheduled in that building. They'd only just bought the building. They'd been raising money for some years and then searching for the property. And so the four women who had been working on the project, getting the money together, finding the building, finally got the building, set up the programme, put out the programme, and I'd just asked for ordination, got the programme, and signed up for the first retreat. So I went there in December, or November, I think it's December in 1994. So at that point, there were just four women trying to run that project. And, you know, over the years that I got to know them, I was really, really impressed by what they were doing there together. They said they made a commitment for life when they started that project. I think they didn't really believe that it actually would be for life, but I think they felt that unless they made quite a strong commitment, they wouldn't be able to get such a big project off the ground and make it work. They paid themselves very little. They paid themselves £25 a week, I believe. I mean, it really stuck in my head. Yeah, Hannah, can you live on £25 a week? And over the years, you know, since they started that project, there's been a lot of women have been ordained as a result of that building, that that project. So over those years I was getting to know them in that retreat centre, I was actually working in the vegetarian restaurant that Satya Leela's mentioned. The Wild, it became called, the, it got known as the Wild Cherry later on. It was originally the Cherry Orchard. So there I was working with a team of Buddhist women, and I liked the way that there was just a bunch of us, there's about six or seven of us, different times, there's different numbers of women, and we were running the whole project together. So we were responsible for the whole thing, from the food to the finances, right the way through. And I think in a way, it felt at the time, as I took that on, it felt like an extension, quite a natural extension of these sort of friendships that I'd been building up to my climbing experiences. But there was a sort of level of trust that you had to have in order to agree how you shared money, but also agree how you shared time and work together in that way. And that, when I first joined the Cherry, we were actually living and working together. So there was a small community. And those of us who worked at the Cherry, almost all of us lived together. And I was thinking about some particular aspects of that. It became a very sort of strong, I suppose, for me personally. I noticed that when I started to live and work with the same bunch of women, that I had to let myself be seen. I had to actually let all of myself be seen. I realised that in my previous existence, my previous life, I kind of had parts of my life that didn't really meet up. There's like my family, my socialist friends, my climbing friends, my work friends, and they didn't really know each other particularly. There weren't many overlaps between those groups of people. And there's sort of ways in which I was a fairly different person when I was with different groups of folk, actually. So there was this sort of weird experience when I started living and working with the same group of people, that there was at least a few people on the planet who actually saw all these different aspects of me in the same place. And then the other thing that I noticed about living and working with the same people was that I had to actually deal with conflicts as they came up rather than running away, which had been my previous method of dealing with conflict. Run away very quickly. So since I actually lived and worked with them, it wasn't like I could go home at the end of the workday and, you know, complain about other people to somebody else. I had to actually, you know, meet them over the supper table and then meet them at breakfast, and, you know, that meant communicating about what was going on for me. And I think there was another level of fear. Well, I had a lot of fear around conflict, but there was another level of fear as well that I noticed that I had to work with, and that was in a way a bit more subtle, but it was a fear that actually if people really got to know me sort of fully, they wouldn't actually like me. They'd probably go off me quite quickly. And yeah, I think I dealt with that in other situations by moving around quite fast. I suppose having these different groups of people that I could sort of spend different amounts of time with meant that I didn't have to face that fear. So there was this, quite a lot of fear involved in it. And I noticed actually at one point when I was working in the kitchen, with my feet firmly on the ground, that I was actually probably more anxious in this situation in the kitchen, where I was realising that I was in some kind of level of difficulty with somebody else there. And that even sort of being in a nice, comfortable kitchen with the earth close to my feet, I was probably more frightened there than I had been in quite a lot of situations on a vertical rock face with thousands of feet below me. And just a miserable little bit of rope. Yeah, so it was, it had its ups and downs, those 6 years that I spent at the Cherry before I was ordained. But, survived it. I was ordained on the two-month retreat, as Satchalila mentioned, in 2001, and came back and continued to work in the team for another 3 years after that. But a year after my ordination, my mum died. And she died of cancer. And she died quite slowly. She was given a terminal diagnosis and then died 3 months later. So, I spent quite a bit of time with her during that time. But I noticed, I'd been ordained at that point, but I found that it left me watching her dying process and being aware of my own experience of her death. It actually left me with quite a lot of doubt about my Buddhist practice. There was a sort of point at which I couldn't see how my own practice, although I enjoyed meditation, I loved study, had lots of friends, I was working in a team, living in a community, joined the order. All this sort of practice that I felt was quite strong at that point, I didn't really see how it was going to help me if I had to face what she had faced, a kind of level of existential fear, basically, around dying of cancer. So I decided at that point that it would be good. I sort of needed a situation where I could throw myself into particularly my meditation practice more fully. So, East London's a pretty busy place, especially around the RBC. And I sort of thought, well, maybe I could take my meditation practice quite a lot deeper than I was doing at the Cherry. So it's at that point that I decided to go and spend 6 months at Gampo Abbey, which is the sort of monastic setup that Pema Chodron was involved in for a number of years. She still is involved there, actually, though she doesn't live there. So. So at that time, which was 2003, you could go and stay in Gampo Abbey, but you needed to make a commitment to staying there for at least 6 months. So it wasn't like a sort of retreat, which you could just go on for a couple of weeks and you'd be on retreat and then come home again. You had to make quite a big commitment. 6 whole months meant probably for a lot of people changing your job, sorting out lots of stuff at your family situation. During those first 6 months, you weren't supposed to go out and visit or have holidays or anything. So it was quite a major life change to do that, to go there for 6 months. And once you were there, you got to live and work as part of a community rather than being on a sort of special retreat thing. It was just a community living and practicing together. And about 30 or 40 men and women, it was mixed, more or less half and half, all living in the same quite large building. And there's a lot of meditation. We had silent mornings with meditation practice through the mornings. And then in the afternoon, there was about 4 hours of work time. And I was doing cooking because they had heard about the fact I worked at the Cherry. So they thought they'd use me as a cook. And then in the evening, there's more meditation and silence again. So it's this sort of big old extended farmhouse. And it's on a cliff top above the Gulf of St. Lawrence in Nova Scotia. And so right at the end of this sort of dirt road, and you have to drive for about 40 minutes before you get to any settlement with like shops or anything in it. And it's in among forests, so there's maple trees and spruce trees around, which included moose and bears, which just made it seem so foreign. It's quite amazing. So Chogyam Trungpa was the guy who set this up. Apparently Chogyam Trungpa worked with Bhante when he first came to Britain from Tibet. As a very well, Chogyam Trungpa was a very young man at that point. And then he moved to America and he started the Shambhala movement there. And apparently he came from a family that was quite proud of its sort of warrior traditions. And he interpreted many of the Buddhist teachings in terms of this sort of analogy archetype, I suppose, of the warrior archetype. He thought as well that the closest that you get in the West to what he considered to be a monastic life was actually the army. And which seems quite strange to us, doesn't it? And the motto of Gampo Abbey is discipline. Apparently, Chogyam Trungpa, and I think other Tibetan Buddhists are not quite sure about this bit, but they translate the word sila or shila, which we translate as ethics. They translate it by the word discipline, the English word discipline. So, you know, when I got there, I discovered this. I hadn't realised this beforehand, but I got there and discovered this fact. And I suppose how they see that in terms of a monastic lifestyle is that there are particular forms or structures that the life there includes, and you're supposed to just follow those structures, follow those forms, as in a sort of disciplined way. It included quite a lot of fairly small rules of what you did when. And, so for instance, if I was part of the flag duty that week, it wasn't just a matter of getting your flags up on the flagpoles. There's five flagpoles out there. But you had to carry the flags in a particular way and march in step with the other people, because there's five flags, there's five of us carrying them, and somebody else to play a penny whistle. You had to march in step down to the flagpoles. Okay, so you can imagine from my socialist feminist background. Raise them all at the same time, and then you got to stand back from your flagpole, and then you got to sing. this thing they called the Shambhala Anthem. For some reason, this irritated me immensely. This particular aspect of it irritated me immensely. Luckily, I didn't actually have to do this very often because the weather was terrible, and when the weather was bad, you didn't raise the flags. Anyway, there were some other little aspects of this discipline that I found difficult. One was on certain days, or basically, you weren't supposed to eat food that needed to be chewed after 2 o'clock in the afternoon on certain days. So most of the time, it was fine. They had this really nice locally made bread and peanut butter and jam and things sort of stuck on the side. You weren't allowed to go in the kitchen, but you could eat this bread and you toast it and make it nice or whatever any time of the day or night. You felt like it, except on the non-chew days when you weren't supposed to. Yeah, they put this bread and jam and everything away at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. But quite often, because of my work, I might have been actually doing some of the work in the morning and then having the afternoon free, so I would have made myself a sandwich. In the afternoon, I'd go for a walk in the forest to check out the moose and the bears with my sandwich in my bag. And, so I might find myself sitting out under a tree in the snow and the cold. Yeah, it was winter time I was there. And take out my sandwich and be just about to eat it when I suddenly realised, actually, it was a non-chew day and it was after 2 o'clock in the afternoon. By that time, I was looking at my watch. It's 3 o'clock. So I remember doing this a few times. I can't remember how many, actually. But I remember sitting there looking at it in the middle of absolutely nowhere. Okay, so it's a completely isolated place. And wondering what was the skillful thing to do under these circumstances. So I thought, okay, should I not eat this because it's what I agreed to when I came to Gampo Abbey? I was happy to fit in with their rules and regulations. It's only for 6 months, after all. Should I not eat it because if I fitted in with the rules, that kind of supports the whole situation, it supports other people and what they're doing, so it'd make the whole place a more harmonious place somehow. And then I thought, well, maybe I could not decide not to eat it because I could probably do with losing a bit of weight, and I could do with developing a bit of self-restraint about food, and you know, maybe I'm just being a bit greedy and deciding to eat this, you know, snack, basically. Anyway, so I'd use these different ideas on myself at different times and try and work out what was the sensible thing to do. I think one time I did just eat it, honestly. It's probably a confession. So the idea of I thought the idea of not eating it, because the reason why I had this rule is because it links in with the idea that traditionally the Buddha would have not eaten after midday, and he asked his disciples also not to eat after midday. So by the time it got to 21st century Canada, it had turned into this idea that after 2 o'clock in the afternoon you don't eat food, that you have to chew. I don't think the Buddha, on certain days, yeah, and not on other days. You know, minus 15 degrees, okay, 3 foot of snow, and I've just been snowshoeing up the hill, so it's all right. To just do with a nice sandwich. Anyway, there we go. You can imagine my dilemma. And apparently other people also found some of these discipline things tricky. During the 6 months that I was there, I saw six people leave before they had done their 6 months. Time that they decided that they had committed to, and like I say, it was a big commitment to make. You know, a lot of people had given up jobs and all sorts of things in order to do it. There seemed to be a sort of a 3 month crunch point when people sort of threw up their hands in horror and decided that was it, they were off. Yeah, but there was still quite a strong core of men and women who were happy with this way of life, and they stayed. And they seemed to hit another sort of difficult point around 2 or 3 years after they started. And that seemed to be when people usually left. So while I was there was only one person who had been there for 5 years, and also three older people who had been involved quite early on when Chogyam Trungpa was still alive and were personal disciples of his, who were very committed practitioners. Apparently, Pema Chodron said that she was told by one of her Tibetan teachers that probably establishing monasticism in the West would be very, very hard indeed, sort of harder than establishing Buddhism practice. And I sort of thought maybe that's because of our tendency to be a bit suspicious of rules and regulations, and certainly that was my tendency. So, you know, I puzzled about whether to eat my sandwich on a few occasions, and I felt very rebellious about singing that anthem, which I'm glad to say I can't remember at all, and several other pointless activities that you're supposed to do at different times. And I realised that I actually had a big question about this sort of discipline as a spiritual practice. And I thought maybe it was just a way of keeping less committed people out of the abbey, because people left quite quickly if they didn't like it. And I was thinking, well, it's a bit weird, because my life at the Cherry, the Wild Cherry restaurant in East London, was actually quite a structured life. I was living in the community, and we did community nights once a week. And in the Cherry, you know, I'd need to make sure that I took my lunch break at precisely the right time, otherwise I'd mess up other people's lunch breaks. And, you know, so I'd have to, you know, I was quite sort of clear about, well, leading a fairly structured life anyway. So in a way, I was a bit surprised at how irritated I got at these different structures at Genpo Abbey. And I thought, in a way, the difference between these two parts of my life was that, at the Cherry, we kind of decided on our rules ourselves. You know, we sat down and thought them out. I've been a part of the process of deciding what we did when. And they're all useful ways of making our work sustainable. Whereas in the monastery, you know, the rules are pretty arbitrary as far as I could see, and I hadn't been part in designing them at all. And I also noticed that at the Cherry, I could try and carry out my duties as well as I could, and I'd feel proud of myself if what I did went well, and I'd feel ashamed of myself if it went badly, or if I messed up, or you know, forgot something, or whatever. But at Genpo Abbey, it was kind of like nobody actually would know if I ate my sandwich sitting out on the hill like that. Nobody would see it. And, you know, a few times I did this sort of walking out of step deliberately while I was carrying my flag in a kind of grumpy sort of way, and keep my mouth shut while everyone else was singing their anthem. But actually, I just got completely ignored. It made no difference whatsoever. I mean, there were some regulations that I would have got thrown out if I disobeyed. So we were all supposed to be in the shrine room for every single sit. And if you didn't turn up, you know, they had a little person taking the register at the door of the shrine room. If you didn't turn up, you'd eventually be asked to leave the abbey well, quite briskly probably. But actually, you know, I wanted to be on the meditation, so that wasn't an issue for me. And about halfway through my time there, these 6 months, I realised that actually it was, well, it was really only my ego that was making it a problem, which is quite an interesting sort of recognition for me. Because none of these things that I was being supposed to do were actually difficult or painful or problematic in themselves. It was kind of my ego, my self-important me, that was getting in the way. And after a while, I could actually stand back and see how funny it was, really, that but somehow I thought I was making a big stand by not singing. And, you know, what's so terrible, really, about marching in step? Or even letting somebody else decide whether I could eat a sandwich on one day and not on another day. So I think that was quite an important experience for me. And I think it was partly to do with, you know, spending this 6 months in the ice and snow in Canada that left me feeling that I could actually decide to come and work at Tiwat and Loka. So Tiwat and Loka, I hasten to add, is very different ethos. We don't have discipline written over the entranceway. And yeah, in some ways it's very, very different setup. But there is an aspect of it that that does remind me a little bit of this. I was thinking that while spending my life basically helping women to join the order does mean that I have to let go of the part of me that says, well, what's in this for me? You know, what's the payback for me? Having to let go of the sort of what's in it for me attitude actually leads to quite a deep freedom. And I think what I found interesting in it in particular is that, well, I suppose ideally, maybe it sort of sounds a bit grandiose, but I was thinking that ideally, letting go of the sort of self-important me, I found that I'm capable of a lot more kindness. My sort of, particularly sort of slightly grumpy attitude to all these regulations and rules at Gampo Abbey, was kind of quite critical, quite negative, really. And I find since sort of being a bit more free of that, I am capable of more kindness than I was before. And I was reflecting a bit on Bhante. Apparently, you know, Chogyam Trungpa was setting up this Shambhala group just only a bit after Bhante had started setting up our movement. So there's a sense in which they're kind of, well, trying to do quite a parallel, well, sort of two parallel projects, really, trying to bring Buddhism into the West in a form that worked for Westerners. But whereas Trungpa sort of saw himself as a warrior, Bhante's always seen himself as a poet. And I do think that's coloured quite deeply the way our movement works as a movement. And it's an aspect of Bhante that I really love, actually. Yeah, so I'm going to finish this talk by reading a poem by Bhante. And it's a poem called The Unseen Flower. The Unseen Flower. Compassion is far more than emotion. It is something that springs up in the emptiness, which is when you yourself are not there, so that you do not know anything about it. Nobody, in fact, knows anything about it. If they knew it, it would not be compassion. But they can only smell the scent of the unseen flower that blooms in the heart of the void.